Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 55 for June 22nd, 2010. I'm Dominic Rabier, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, the Supreme Court hands down a decision in the Quan text messaging case. Then, AT&T and Apple experience privacy problems with the latest iPhone 4 pre-ordering. And finally, the FTC has a provocative staff paper on saving print journalism. And now that I'm done alliterating on the letter P, Ben, do you want to talk about our first story, the Quan case that the Supreme Court handed down?
Absolutely. So this case, we talked about it back on podcast 31. So actually not that long ago. The Supreme Court then had just granted cert. They agreed to hear the case, and they held arguments in April. And just decided this case this past Monday? 17th?
Yes.
I guess the 17th was Thursday, sorry.
Oh, that's right. This was a Thursday week for opinions.
Yeah, there was one on Monday and one on Thursday. So at near the end of the term, the Supreme Court starts releasing cases on Mondays and Thursdays so they can release all of them. Like, I think as of last Monday, they had 24 unreleased cases, so they wanted to, by releasing them, 2 days a week, you don't have to do 8 cases every day. You can do 4 cases each day and get through their entire backlog before the end of the month. Anyway, so to give you a brief discussion of what this case is about, Mr. Quan, who was a SWAT team member of the City of Ontario in California, was issued a text messaging pager, a little alphanumeric pager by his department, for use in rapid response to emergencies. Now, he ended up using that for illicit purposes. He was using it to send sexually explicit text messages to his mistress, who I believe was a secretary in the department. And as a result of these text messages, he went over his limit. His text messaging limit several months in a row. And initially he was told that the pagers would be treated the same way as department email. That was, it could be searched at any time. They could, always go in and look at the transcripts of the text messages just as they could the emails. He was later told that if he didn't pay the overages for his text messaging, he went over, the number of characters he was allotted. If he didn't pay for that overage, people would go in and look at it to see if he was using it properly. Now, what ended up happening is he went over a few months in a row, as apparently some other people did, and one of the people got fed up at, going around collecting text, collecting these overages fees from the officers. And as a result, called up the phone company and said, listen, phone company, can we get the transcripts? I want to see if people are using these legitimately, and we have to increase the limits, or if people are using them illegitimately, and we've got to change a policy or, punish people for this. So they got the transcripts. They found that Mr. Quan had been using these for non-work-related purposes, and he was disciplined, although to what degree he was disciplined isn't 100% clear. And the Supreme Court took cert. They decided the case, and they did. They basically copped out as much as they could on this opinion.
Justice Kennedy has a line that says, though the case touches issues of far-reaching significance, the court concludes it can be resolved by settled principles determining when a search is reasonable.
Right. There were three kind of, two really important issues that this case could have addressed, and that was whether there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in text messages and whether search of these text messages constituted a search under the Fourth Amendment. And the Supreme Court very explicitly in their opinion said, we're not deciding either of those two issues. We're just saying that in the case of searches, sometimes, when you work for the government, you still have a reasonable expectation of privacy in certain things, and your Fourth Amendment rights do apply. You do have some amount of privacy, even if you're employed by the government. But all of that is subject to this kind of special exception that the Supreme Court has created, where they can do the employer can do any type of search that's reasonable. And this exception was created for things like railroad. Conductors. There was a period of time where railroad conductors abused drugs and therefore created very dangerous situations. So I think it was Congress or some regulatory body passed a law regulation that said conductors would be subject to random searches, random drug screens. And they sued, saying that this violates our Fourth Amendment right to privacy. It's a search or seizure without a probable cause. And the Supreme Court said, well, yeah, it is, but it's reasonable because, you know, you guys are employed by the government. You're doing something important, and screwing up can be very dangerous. And they basically applied that rubric here.
And now, they found?
They found that it was reasonable, that the search was reasonable. And that in this case, and they also very explicitly limited it to these facts. So, you know, we're dealing with a case where the employer purchases an alphanumeric pager, gives it to the employee, and they're paying for the bill, and there's some sort of written policy that says it's open to search at any time, just like email, you know. And when you're limiting a case like that to those specific facts, and when you're dodging in the major issues, it's pretty clear that the court just didn't want to. They took this case because they thought the Ninth Circuit got it wrong, and not because they wanted to address any of the important issues that were involved.
You know, I've kind of always felt, since we covered this story before, that this was just a bad case to go up to test this principle on the bigger level rather than just on the facts. And that's just because the facts are so limiting. I mean, we're talking about a device that was actually distributed by the police department, and because of that, you know, and there were other contracts involved with regard to how you were supposed to report the amount of time that you were using the device for, how many, you know, how much data that you were sending, and it was all subject to review basically by an internal person who took care of all of that. I mean, all of that stuff just leads me to believe that this is a government-issued device. It is not something that's a personal device, and that probably makes it one of the biggest differences between that and like a cell phone that one of us might carry in our pockets on the job. And because of that, like, it just seems to be so easily subject to this work-related exception that, you know, this case was sort of uninteresting to go before the Supreme Court, I thought.
Right. I mentioned in the previous podcast where we discussed this that, you know, there wasn't a circuit split, so the lower courts of appeal were not divided on how to address this issue, because this is pretty much the first time that at least I could find that this came up. You know, it just wasn't a great case for the Supreme Court to take, and the Supreme Court responded to that appropriately by not dealing with this case in a way that's particularly helpful for future analysis or to understand where search and seizure law is going as it relates to electronic devices.
Well, it's really hard to speculate on, I guess, why the Supreme Court actually took this, other than, you know, they must have thought that the Ninth Circuit got it wrong, because you have a 9-0 opinion here. But I guess maybe, or I sort of wonder if it's because they wanted to avoid an eventual split in the circuits, because they did think the Ninth Circuit got it wrong, and maybe that would cause dissension amongst the ranks of the circuit courts.
Yeah, the biggest theory for why they took it is because after the Ninth Circuit decided this case, the City of Ontario petitioned for what's called a rehearing in bank, where they wanted a subset. I think the Ninth Circuit does something like 11 judges out of the Ninth Circuit will all assemble and hear the case in a big panel and then issue another opinion. It's basically an appeal within the circuit. And there was a dissent from the denial of a rehearing in bank. So one of the judges who gets to decide whether or not they actually do the rehearing in this case, you know, wanted there to be a rehearing and wrote a very strongly worded dissent about why it should in fact be reheard, which, you know, is the closest you can get to a circuit split without actually having a circuit split. In the end, though, it looks like this was a case of, you know, the Supreme Court, which says that it's not a court of error. They claim that it's a constitutional court to decide these big, lofty constitutional issues. In the end, they treated themselves like a court of error, where somebody screwed up and they're fixing it, which in a year where the Supreme Court has taken very few cases is not a particularly good use for the Supreme Court's time. I would much rather them be spending their time to deciding important cases than taking a case that was just wrongly decided and reversing it for fun without, you know, helping the law move along at all.
Yeah, that sounds eminently reasonable.
Yeah, I agree.
But at the same time, I'm kind of thankful the court didn't try using this court case to establish a new law of privacy regarding electronic devices, just because, as David mentioned, this case doesn't really have the necessary underpinnings to make that happen, so they would have been coming up with the stuff off the cuff, and it probably would have been pretty weak.
Right. Bad cases make bad law, as the old saying goes. You know, where you have a case with bad facts, you're likely going to have a bad case and bad case law and bad precedent come out of that.
So it was nice to see the court exercise restraint in terms of its actual holding.
Okay, when you put it that way, I agree.
Yeah. Justice Scalia, actually, in his concurrence, goes on to say that he doesn't even think the court should have decided the issue of whether the Fourth Amendment applies to the public employees, because he felt that the search itself was reasonable and you could just use the analysis that a private employee would already have. The issue was kind of confounded because it was the city of Ontario in California, so it was a public employer.
Right. Yeah, this would probably be a very different case if it was the government doing a search on a pager issued by a private employer to a private employee. But, and, you know, again, that wasn't the case here. This was public employee with a device issued by the government.
Right. I mean, it's very analogous to, say, you're working at a company and the company issues you a pager and they say, we retain all our rights, we can look at it any time, and then you're like, hey, you looked at it, that's not fair. Well, that's very reasonable because they told you they would do that. And that's basically what the city did here. So,
I have a quick bone to pick here. Do people actually still use two-way pagers? Because the term pager is something that I equate to like a decade ago. I don't know how you guys feel about it. I mean, most people tend to use, I guess, cell phones and just like smartphones with the data transmission capabilities.
I mean, every now and then you still see IT people who have a pager that's hooked into some like server system or some legacy cooling system that if the cooling system breaks down, they get a page instead of a email or an SMS. But I personally don't know anyone who still uses a two-way alphanumeric pager.
Few places I've seen it used are places where it was set up 20 years ago and hasn't changed, and there's no reason for it to change.
True. Do you guys have a handle on when these events actually occurred, how long ago they were? It looks like I'm seeing dates here from the opinion that are at least 2002.
Early 2000.
When they were reviewing this. Yeah, so probably 10 years ago. How about that?
Amazing how that works out. Anything else on this story?
I'm all set.
I think we're good.
All right, our next story is the iPhone 4 AT&T pre-ordering disaster. We can also talk about the iPad leak, but first we'll just focus on the iPhone 4 pre-ordering disaster. Basically, AT&T started pre-ordering for the iPhones. People would sign on, log in, and find that they had someone else's information. For example, a guy named John King and logged in and saw that he got Mary's profile and saw her credit card information and her phones. And basically, AT&T apparently showed the wrong customers the wrong account information. Instead of showing you your account information, they showed you someone else's. This is pretty much a violation of people's privacy, and it happened to a lot of people. Go ahead.
What I found most interesting about this case is I have yet to see this case, this incident, that AT&T, at least that I've seen, hasn't issued any sort of explanation or even any type of notification. So I haven't seen any official response. Particularly, I haven't seen that AT&T has notified the people, the victims, the people whose information was wrongly displayed. Because I would like to know if my information came up on somebody else's account, you know, when they logged in.
Yeah. They did take their system down offline pretty quickly after it happened and then took down the iPhone 4 eligibility page entirely. But yeah, they don't seem to be reacting to it at all.
I guess that wouldn't have stopped anyone from writing down the information as soon as they saw it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. The corollary to this was that at the same time, AT&T's servers that authenticated whether or not somebody was the eligibility servers, what Apple's backend would check to see if somebody was eligible for an upgrade. Also, were up and down throughout the entire day, making it very difficult for people to pre-order iPhones.
In fact, the only servers that were working for eligibility checking were the text message servers that if you sent them a text or a page, an alphanumeric page, you would get an alphanumeric page or text message back. So perhaps that old technology holding on.
Yeah, I got in under the wire. I guess I woke up early enough on the East Coast that I was able to reserve my iPhone 4 without much of a problem.
I use the Apple app on the iPhone itself.
How's your BlackBerry doing, David?
It's awesome, thank you. Although, I think I might move finally over to a Droid or an Android-based phone pretty soon.
So, is AT&T potentially liable to its customers for this in any way? I mean, is this some sort of it's obviously a violation of privacy, but is it an actionable violation of privacy?
I would say that if AT&T, if somebody's private information was stolen as a result of this and there was some use of that information, identity theft, for instance, the customer could probably sue AT&T for negligence, although I'm sure there's something in my contract with AT&T that says I have to arbitrate this thing as opposed to actually bringing a lawsuit somewhere and that I'd have to arbitrate it in, you know, Iceland. But, and I'm just, most of that is joking. I don't actually know if there's an arbitration clause, but my guess is, you know, that seems like a fairly reasonable negligence cause of action, that AT&T knew or should have known that something was up. They had a duty to protect our information, and they breached that duty. And, you know, the only remaining thing is whether or not there is some damage that flowed out of that. And in the case of identity theft, there would be.
They haven't come out and confirmed what the problem was yet, have they?
Again, not that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, you could, I'm sure you could just lodge a suit basically for negligence, saying that this was negligent handling of sensitive information. I don't know, but beyond like that common law type of a tort, which I think, as you mentioned, Ben, would be limited by any contracts that you've agreed to, you know, when you've signed on to the AT&T service. But aside from that, you know, I don't know that there are any statutes out there that would really help you along with this case. But it is sort of interesting because this type of stuff becomes more and more common, it seems, as we go forward, and it hasn't really gone away as an issue. I mean, we talk about everyone moving information all up into the cloud and having that be accessible from a certain location or anywhere, you know, just because it's all based on servers that you can access from any web portal. Because of that, I guess, you know, it's sort of concerning that you might not have a good way to get back at a company. Let's say it's a really egregious breach of personal information, financial information. Because you signed on to their services and agreed to a contract that might really limit your ability to recover after a lawsuit, you know, you could be left with your hands tied behind your back and not really be able to go after a company for something that was truly negligent.
Yeah, from what I understand, the reason behind the AT&T glitch here was they were upgrading a new system and didn't test it at all before the iPhone 4 pre-ordering started. They were actually trying to prevent, they were apparently trying to install extra fraud security measures, ironically enough.
Huh.
Wow. I heard that was the explanation for why the authentication, why the, you know, the back-end authentication, whether or not you can upgrade servers, went down. Are you reading something that says that that's the same explanation for why they were showing people the wrong information?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay. I mean, it's certainly plausible that something like that happened.
That appears to be just sloppy coding in terms of the login code. Basically, they're not using ACID-based transactions, and instead are writing transactions while on ACID.
That last part was a joke.
Yes, a terrible one. ACID being a form of programming regarding databases that basically a transaction, the whole idea is that you do all of this at once or don't do it at all, and ACID is an acronym that basically spells out the four things that you need for that to happen. In any case, a related story for this is the iPad, 3G, Apple 3G iPad owners, who also are on AT&T because AT&T's 3G powers the iPad. Although, I guess you could use other 3G networks as well. No, you couldn't use other 3G networks. You would have to use a mobile Wi-Fi hotspot. But in any case, Apple 3G iPad owners, they had all their email addresses exposed because of another security breach at AT&T. A security group revealed it basically used a way, a breach, it basically found a way into AT&T's website and got 114,000 email addresses of iPad users. And then they made this public, and AT&T got really angry at them and said, oh, you guys hacked into our system. And the security group basically said, we disclose this as a service to our nation. We love America, and the idea of Russians or Chinese being able to subvert American infrastructure is a nightmare. We understand that many good deeds go punished, but AT&T is trying to crucify us over this. So the first question is AT&T liable for having the security breach? And the second question is, could there be any repercussions against the security group for actually going in and breaking in to show the vulnerability itself?
Again, the AT&T thing is going to be... they're going to get smacked pretty hard because as a result of the security breach, several high-ranking White House and military officials had their private email addresses exposed. Why military officials are using the iPad, perhaps a little beyond me. You'd think that they'd have to go through some sort of extra security levels before that. I mean, if Barack Obama can't actually use a legitimate BlackBerry and has to use some more sort of special CIA BlackBerry-like device, you'd think you would not let high-ranking military officials go out to the corner and buy an iPad and use that for work.
But that was... I'm sorry to stop you there. I mean, that was for different reasons, though. That was really because he was talking about mixing... we're talking about President Obama and his BlackBerry... It was all about mixing personal communication with official communication through the White House, and then the security issues that might be that might go around with using a BlackBerry. And a big part of this had to do with Freedom of Information Act and actual disclosures of communications made during official duties as president, I believe. Does that ring a bell?
I think that's an important issue that, you know, he's going to have secure information going over those phone lines, and you're going to want the data going in and out of that to be encrypted, but you'd think that you'd also want that for high-ranking military officials.
Okay, I see your point here. I thought it was more along the lines of, like, oh, it's not fair. If Obama doesn't get one, why should these guys get one? Silly generals.
No. I'm wondering why high-ranking military officials are buying off-the-shelf hardware if they're worried about security.
Yeah, I guess that is a more interesting question. Maybe, hopefully they're not using it to plan out, you know, strategic movements of troops or anything
military
like that.
Military strike. But the touchpad interface is great for directing troops.
Sounds like Command and Conquer to me.
Listen, I can just tap on the map here, and the troops will go there. It's just like StarCraft.
Okay, enough RTS jokes.
So, I think you were saying, Ben, before David jumped in, that AT&T is potentially liable over this? If
I think,
hurt.
Again, they'd be liable in tort, you know, presuming that there isn't any sort of other bar to bringing a tort suit for it. As for other breaches of privacy, again, that's most likely going to be a state-to-state thing. I think the much more interesting question is the security group, especially because they already raided the home of one of the people who was in the security group that exposed it, found drugs in his home, and arrested him for that, which is totally unrelated to the actual alleged hacking incident.
One of the security group?
Yeah, one of the members of the security group. His home was raided in connection with the investigation into their exposing this data, and he was arrested for possession of various, I think it was mostly prescription drugs.
That's unfortunate for him. How about the security group? Is it vulnerable by the people who've had their email addresses exposed by them because of the security hole that AT&T neglected to fix? Or might not even been aware of?
I think that's a much more interesting question. So the first thing you'd have to look at is whether or not this was a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, whether or not they gained unauthorized access or exceeded their authorized access to the server. And from what I understand about the attack is that they were just clever and submitted IMEI numbers, I think it was. So some information about the iPad that they extrapolated, they submitted that to the AT&T server, and the AT&T server belched out all of these email addresses in response, which doesn't really strike me as exceeding authorized access if all it's doing is if all the people are doing are being clever and not actually. I mean, this is the most basic of hacks in that you're using a feature of the software, and it's not, you're not exploiting any code, you're not guessing a password, you're not, you know, putting any...
But to play devil's advocate, they're not authorized to view those things.
Yeah, I mean, I love your passion for arguing that, Ben, but I just find it to be such a wayward argument that would never hold up in court, because there's no way that those guys could ever have been authorized to communicate with a server in that sort of way.
I mean, but what if somebody doesn't want me to ping their server but forgets to disable ping? Am I exceeding my authorized access to their server by pinging it?
That's a simple send and ACK request, basically, as far as I know. I mean, those are the types of communications that happen on a daily basis.
But as opposed to logging into the website, which doesn't happen on a regular basis, because that's essentially all they were doing. They were submitting, I forget what bit of information about the iPad it was.
Was it falsified credentials?
So, from what I understand about this, you submit some information about your iPad to this AT&T server, and as the AT&T server then fills in your email address in a form that you're filling out on the AT&T server, what they did is they extrapolated that, they found several iPads whose information had been posted online, extrapolated a bunch of other numbers out from that, submitted all of those numbers to the AT&T server, and AT&T spat back all of the email addresses.
I still think it was done in a way that was meant to trick the servers into spitting back information, and because of that, it means that they were trying to exceed unauthorized access, to gain access to information that they would not have otherwise had.
The way I see it is, I kind of agree with Ben in that the server's giving information when prompted with the right information that isn't, like, a password, isn't something secure, it's just obscure. And AT&T is trying to say that, oh, well, because you use this hard-to-find number that you shouldn't have immediately thought of, but you did because you're smart, well, now you're hacking into our system because you're changing the URL you go to. And there were controversies like this. I think there was one over business school admission or something. People could see whether they had been admitted to a business school by just changing the URL. And the business school was like, well, that's hacking. You're changing the URL. That's not fair. But, I mean, how do people navigate the web if not by typing in URLs? It seems like this is a similar sort of situation. You've got a form. You type in a number. Well, they typed in a different number. And got the result for someone else, and then probably scripted it together to get all these email addresses.
Okay, yeah, I think it's a fair point, and I can appreciate what you guys are trying to argue here. But I guess my biggest problem, and I haven't articulated this well, is just that the statute doesn't differentiate on how well you've tried to protect your systems versus how crappily you've done at protecting your systems, or just trying to use, you know, obscurity rather than actual technical security measures to protect sensitive information. And because of that, it's like analogous, I guess, to saying that you still might be violating that statute if you walked up to a computer terminal that you were not allowed to walk up to and basically were able to gain access to the computer physically, maybe just by clicking a couple of buttons to get in. It seems to be the same argument. If the property was not yours and that the server was not meant or not intended to send out that information to you, then you might be violating the statute then, just because you're exceeding what people or what the company wanted you to have in terms of access.
My problem with your argument, David, is that under your framework, I never authorized Comcast to send random disconnect packets to my computer while I was using BitTorrent, yet they did it. And just because I didn't think to block disconnect packets from Comcast, I didn't phrase that last part properly, but I think under your scheme, they would be liable for abuses of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act because they were exceeding their authorized access to my computer by sending disconnect packets to me.
But did you sign a contract when you got your Comcast services, though? And did that probably have provisions in it about quality of access? And, I mean, I'm sure that Comcast is always sending you packets of some kind, whether you want them to or not.
Yeah, and I'm always sending AT&T packets of some kind. The only difference is what's in those packets. And in that case, it was a disconnect packet that was, you know, messing with my computer and messing with my interactions with other computers.
All right.
I think we've panned out our arguments pretty well here.
I think we're going to have to agree to disagree here and hope that the Supreme Court has a wonderful case to rule on this one way or the other. We'll put the link to AT&T's letter in the show notes where they actually describe what they think happened, and it seems to pretty much agree with what we've been talking about in terms of the scripting. And we'll leave you to make your own conclusion, and feel free to comment on the podcast and perhaps even engage in debate furthermore. Moving on to our last story, the FTC staff paper on how to save print journalism in a world gone digital.
Yes, so this story was released this week, I think sometime around June 13th or 14th, and it is actually coming before a large staff meeting at the Federal Trade Commission. And I'm sure everyone can probably remember just last fall and in December, these new rules were enacted that were all about blogging standards and whether or not you had to disclose certain connections with products that you were reviewing and any financial connections you had to the company that manufactured those products. Just like that and what the FTC was doing in the blogging or the blogosphere, they also seem to be pretty active in the journalism sphere, and we're talking print media, not necessarily online media. And this week they came out with a paper that are basically guidelines on, or more like discussion points, I should say, about what they are perceiving some of the problems to be in print media today, and how they might be able to save print media. And this is a very controversial topic I think everyone can agree on here, because we've seen the demise of a lot of newspapers across the United States. It's not fun to watch anybody lose jobs, to watch people, you know, out of a job because the way that the news cycle has changed in the last 10, 15, maybe even 20 years is such that you don't need such a large staff. A lot of people are looking to online news sources in order to get information about what's going on in the world. Sometimes that's news aggregators, and sometimes that's going directly to websites like the New York Times and looking at articles there, rather than paying to receive the print media at your doorstep every morning. And this paper that was released this week discusses, in part, some the way that the newspapers have been traditionally making money is through by selling advertising in their print media, and we're talking about, you know, those huge large one page displays of advertising, the big Macy's ads that you might have seen in some of the New York Times. The list goes on, and they also make a little bit of money off of selling through classified ads as well. It's much harder these days to sell advertising online than it is offline in the print media, I think, because you get analytics based on who's clicking through on ads on a website. You can sometimes even create small profiles on users as they visit your website. You can kind of get a feel for age demographics, you know, and maybe a few other simple things too, what kind of software they're using on their computer, whether they're on OS X or whether they're on Windows or Linux, and what browser they're using. So you can build these little profiles. But also through that, you know when people are not clicking on ads. Unlike print media, when you could just open the paper and see a bunch of stuff, you never knew who was actually looking at it. It was all about getting people to look at your paper. Well, anyhow, all of that has pretty much gone away, and papers are finding it incredibly hard to make as much money as they used to make by printing out their papers online through sale of ads. And the FTC came up with a number of what I would call provocative discussion points about ways that they think that the print media can be saved. And they have even recommended, and I think the two most controversial, at least in my mind, are they want to officially recognize something called the hot news doctrine, which is a doctrine that under the copyright law, basically news groups who have, let's say, a news group or a news company has resources in foreign territory. Let's say they have them in Afghanistan or something, and they get word of very hot news, a very interesting story, and they get that story written up and out on the wire right away. And as soon as all the other news companies out there get word that this is going on, then they sort of go out, send their journalists out, and then write up derivative works, or I don't want to call them derivative works, but they write up their take on the story. And some people think that that's like misappropriating hot news. And the law is such that this is not something that has been recognized. It's been brought up in a number of court cases. Basically, we're talking about facts versus expression, and the traditional holding has been that you can't really protect core facts under copyright. And then the other quick thing, and we'll discuss both of these amongst the whole panel in just a second here, is that they'd also like to limit the fair use doctrine with respect to news aggregators like Google News and using resources like Microsoft Bing and the like. So anyhow, panel, what do you guys think about what the FTC is proposing here? Is this really a way to save print media? Do we want print media to be saved?
So regarding this hot news doctrine, so say a story breaks and I have a blog and I read the hot news article and then I type up a blog opinion piece, would the hot news doctrine stop me from being able to post that? Or potentially make
Absolutely.
Me lie?
Absolutely. I mean, if you go by what the AP thinks the hot news doctrine should be, yes. Yes, you would be prohibited from commenting and reproducing certain news items that took a particular amount of effort to put together for a certain amount of time until, you know, the AP's rightfully gained monopoly on that hot news had expired.
So one problem that I think news companies are especially facing today is that it's just so easy to copy-paste text online. And because of that, you see a lot of websites which simply copy-paste all of the text out of a hot story and put it up on their own website. And this is done like thousands of times over and over again, so it makes it really hard to police, I think, when you're the newspaper companies. And so because of that and the limitation of the Copyright Act about protecting facts, it makes it difficult for newspapers to go after folks.
The problem isn't that a direct copy is unprotected under copyright law, because the direct copy would be protected. If they went into court and said, look, judge, ignoring the fact that, you know, this article does deal a lot with facts, they stole our article word for word, I don't think there's a judge in the United States who would say, oh, no, you know, this was just facts. It wasn't actual expression. I mean, unless the news story was so short as to make it, you know, essentially a stupid case. Any substantive news story, there are multiple ways of saying it, and you know, the one that the AP wrote was not so tightly worded, so packed with information as to merge the idea of the story with the expression of the story. You know, the problem is that there are millions of these sites, not all of them are in the United States, and that by the time that the FTC would, I'm sorry, not the FTC, the AP or the news company would get around to sending a takedown notice or bringing a lawsuit, all of the clicks have already gone elsewhere. You know, they're not. It's impossible for them to respond fast enough to get this information down when people want to read it.
I think actually you nailed the big points there, and that is because even if you rewrite one of these articles so that it's not a direct copy, and you're absolutely right, if any judge saw a case with a direct copy, it would be copyright infringement. When it gets rewritten like that, and you have a company who has put all their time and resources in, it's very expensive to maintain, you know, journalism contacts abroad, I would imagine, or even if it's just within the U.S., the value of the story, and we really are talking about that sale of advertising again, you want the eyeballs on your website who are looking at the ads and clicking through those ads. If other websites have sort of misappropriated all the hot fire that you bring to the newswire about a story, then you've lost all that revenue potentially. And that's a big distinction from how it used to be in print media, because you'd have to wait until sometimes in the afternoon when news companies would do afternoon prints on, you know, hot stories that had just come out back in the day, or wait till the next morning before you read about something if you didn't catch it on the news that night.
Well, that sounds terrible. I'm sorry. I don't like that world. I don't want to see that doctrine passed.
Not only you, I think a lot of the companies that maintain news aggregators are also very concerned about it. Even though a lot of those news aggregators are not only linking out to stories that are about the same thing, but written by different news agencies, but also because they're linking out to the original stories. And Some people say that just linking out like that, or sometimes showing short little previews of what the story is about, might constitute copyright infringement. But news aggregators have long said, even if you could consider this copyright infringement, which linking out is not, it still might be fair use. But the next proposal by the FTC is to limit fair use, to either exclude or not provide as deep of protection for news aggregator companies.
And the FTC doesn't actually have any power when it comes to limiting or expanding fair use. I think it's worth noting. They can, you know, write rules, and they can, you know, make little drawings in their margins and plead to the Supreme Court that fair use should mean this or that when it comes to newspapers. But in the end, it's the Supreme Court and it's the federal courts that decide what fair use means.
Yeah, and not only that, since fair use is also codified in the U.S. Code, the federal statutes, you'd also need Congress to amend the statutes, I think. I mean, I suppose you could have judges that would carve out something, but it would just be easier, in my opinion, for them to approach Congress to try to get legislative action behind this.
Right. I just want to mention quickly that the Supreme Court did endorse the hot news doctrine once back in like the 1920s. It was a case involving the AP, and it involved literally people sending news across country with telegraphs before the company that originally posted the news on billboards could transmit their own stories cross country on telegraph. So we're dealing with a very different world here. And when the Supreme Court addressed that, they basically said it was a misappropriation. But if I recall, they didn't quite pin it under copyright infringement. So it's a doctrine that's been really up in the air for probably the last 40 years, because people just don't know how to apply it in a world that has, you know, teletype and the internet as opposed to telegraphs.
There is, and I guess our listeners should be aware that there are a number of cases out there. And if you look carefully on the internet, you can probably see some links to them, where companies do try to sue other people, and they rely on the basically something akin to the hot news doctrine for the suit. But I don't, as far as I know, a lot of those cases don't really go anywhere. The case law that's out there seems to just point in the direction that this doctrine is pretty much dead and that it's not alive. But maybe what people are really calling for is just, you know, I guess just like the FTC is just a change in the doctrine, and they want to. They'd like to see something like this recognized. I suppose that there's something to be said about having traditional big media out there and helping the news cycle along as they report news stories, because they are organized and there is, you know, some sort of decorum that goes on in those agencies that are all about fact-checking and following up and making sure that you have accurate information in, you know, 99 or 98% of articles that go out. And some people think that you might lose that once these agencies start to die off, or maybe what ends up happening is a lot of the big ones lose enough money that they all start merging together, and we have even less competitors in terms of big media out there than we have today. Anyone else have any other thoughts on this?
I'm set, Dominic.
All set. It'll be interesting to see how this develops.
Yep. Well, like we said, the FTC doesn't really have any power to make anything other than recommendations like they just did here. So I think that wraps us up for this week. Thanks again for listening. You can send us comments at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Visit the website at technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. Okay, so signing off for this week, my name is David O'Brien, and along with me were
Dominic Rabia
and Ben Snitkoff. Thank you, and good night.
Woot.
David O'Brien signing off, along with
Ben Snitkoff.
Dominic Rabia. I always go before you, Ben. What is this?
Sorry, I jumped the gun.